Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out. Huge thanks to all you regular listeners. Keep those likes, shares, and positive reviews coming. If you have a suggestion on what we can do better, we're on every social media platform, so just send us a message.
If you haven't reviewed us yet, especially on iTunes, please do think about highlighting those 5 stars. Every review makes a huge difference to building our audience and helping to make us better.
And if you like what we're doing, consider clicking that support us link on our Anchor FM profile. We use the money to deliver more and better going forward. We get a lot of ideas, just not a lot of cash flow to solve them all or make them all reality. Hey, if this is your first time tuning in, get stoked because we have a great one for you today. Talked to our guest a couple times. I know what he's responsible for, a kind of recent initiative that's making its rounds through the Coast Guard. I really think you guys are going to learn a lot today. And our guest, Mr. John Kopp, born and raised out of sunny Seattle, Washington, went to boot camp back in 2010 with recruit company Yankee 182. First operational assignment, Coast Guard Cutter Midget, back out of his hometown. Struck bosun mate on there, as all good BMs once did. And in 2011, got orders to Station Barnegat Light, New Jersey, a surf station, where he finally advanced to bosun mate third class, and then later made bosun mate second, was fleeted up to that assignment. In 2015, he reported to Station Cape Disappointment, where he certified a surfman and finished his service just a little bit earlier this month. From there, and kind of how we'll close this episode out, is he's also responsible for a brand new memorial on the Coast Guard 44363, and we'll talk about that more at the end. But with that, I'll let Bill ask the question.
I'm excited to ask this question because we've got a surfman on, so I know we're going to get a good answer to it. John, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea stories or stories? Story or stories. That was good.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on.
John's like, I don't even know what you asked me right there.
No, it's funny because it's kind of 2 stories, but they sort of have one common theme. And I thought a little bit about this beforehand, and it's sort of the theme of my whole career as I look back on it, is just like experiential intensity, you know? So whether it's discomfort or excitement or frustration or whatever, you know, these really intense experiences. And so it happened in Barnegat, or both things happened in Barnegat Light. And around 2014, I was pretty much wrapped up with my heavy weather coxswain certification on the 47.
Hey, John, real quick, because we do have listeners that know practically nothing about the Coast Guard, I guess. So could you just describe Barnegat Light and its weak East Coast surf and, you know, I'm just kidding, man. And what kind of boats they have there, kind of your position?
Yeah, so it's a river bar inlet, kind of like you would get on both coasts, but the difference between the East and the West Coast has to do a lot with the power of the swells coming in on the West Coast, you've got swells from thousands of miles away, big, long period, meaty, powerful swells. On the East Coast, the distance those swells have traveled and the power they've accrued is a lot less, potentially. But they're also a lot closer together. Seas are more confused and things like that. So in comparison to, like, Cape Disappointment, it's a very narrow river bar, very shallow, kind of a quicker transit, but pretty sketchy, pretty hairy, whereas, you know, Cape Disappointment's almost the exact opposite. It's deep and wide. But basically, there's shoals, like sandbars, that shift around based on the time of year. And then throughout storms and stuff, or hurricanes, when you have big swells coming from offshore, those waves actually have a lot of energy that transfers down to the bottom of the sea and interacts with the bottom. The waves stand up, they break, and that's what makes it dangerous.
For sure. And I think like the easiest way to describe it too is, like, on the West Coast, it's just this dramatic, almost slow motion power. And on the East Coast, you just get your butt kicked over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, so what about Barnegat Light? Tell us a little about the station.
So yeah, station wise, they had at the time, and they still do, I think, 247s. Then they had two 25 foot response boats. Now they have a 29 or two. And then at the time, they had a 24-foot shallow water special purpose craft for all the back bay response in the intercoastal waterway. So that unit has kind of two unique things going on. It sort of has the ocean river bar inlet type cases that go on, as well as a huge shallow water back bay, kind of like you'd see down the rest of the East Coast or in the Gulf, Florida, that kind of area. So in the summer, the search and rescue caseload is pretty high. There's a huge recreational boating population with a variety of different people. I mean, the Jersey Shore, the TV show, was filmed like 10 miles north of there, so you kind of get that summer crowd.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, and so, you know, they do like 1,000 boardings, no exaggeration, like 1,000 boardings a year.
Is Snooki in this story? That's what I really want to know.
Snooki's not in this story, unfortunately, but it would be pretty sweet.
Sorry, man. Go ahead. We're still laughing about Snooki.
<No. laughs> yeah, and it's, I don't know, I think they have about 45 or so people with a warrant CO and, you know, a typical station organization.
Yeah, and you were story time, like BM3, BM2. What was your role there?
Yeah, it was a BM2, and I was, you know, as a collateral doing stuff in the training department and standing duty and everything. So basically, you know, I did my whole personal qualification standards. So, like, just for anyone who doesn't know that stuff, you basically, there's a bunch of sign-offs and tasks and knowledge that you demonstrate to achieve each level of certification. So coxswain is the first step, and then heavy weather coxswain, which is it ups the levels of wind and seas and surf that you can operate in. And it kind of has a big focus on towing type assistance. So, like, going out and towing a disabled boat in heavy weather. We're doing person in the water recovery. And then once you get that certification, you can work on Surfman, which is pretty much just geared towards kind of like a playbook of things that you're going to do in a surf zone with the boat. So you're going to get into the surf zone, maneuver around, do some kind of task, like pick somebody up out of the water, and then get back out. And so this was basically me going out for my check ride, which is like your driver's test, you know, the final test, for my heavy weather coxswain certification.
Yeah, and for the operational kind of limits on each of those, right? Coxswain, 30 knot winds, 10 foot seas, 8 foot seas. Heavy weather goes up to above a gale, right? And then surfmen are 50 knot winds and what, 30 foot seas, 20 foot breaking surf.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, when you get heavy weather, you can go out, in a lot bigger seas, and then they add that 8 foot surf thing on there. And, you know, it's heavy weather. It's kind of this funny thing. It didn't always exist, the certification, I mean. And it kind of gives you the ability to do some things that aren't quite in the surfer category yet, but aren't really covered by the basic coxswain thing. So, you know, it allows you to get across the breaking bar to go out and assist a vessel. Or if there's some small beach surf, you know, you could safely and within policy get in there and, you know, not have to break policy and effect a rescue.
Yeah, and on a motor lifeboat, 47-foot motor lifeboat, I mean, your height of eye is 14 feet, right? So if you're hitting 10-foot surf, it's below you, and the boat handles that like a, you know.
No big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. Yeah, it's like a speed bump.
Yeah.
Yep. Go ahead, man. Sorry.
So, I mean, you know, going out for my check ride, and I think it was spring of 2014, roughly. And, you know, for these certifications, you kind of have to wait your turn in line with the people ahead of you finish up their certifications and get certified. And then finally, you know, you have your day or your time, where you're kind of the unit's focus. So this is where I was at that point. And I just didn't have a ton of experience towing back in across the bar. And anytime you have waves off your stern, whether you're towing a boat in or you're on your own, that's probably one of the most uncomfortable modes of operation there are. There is, just because you have a tendency to get picked up by the wave and start surfing down the face. And then, you know, many boats, but in particular the 47, has a tendency to kind of tilt slightly onto its side plating, basically, and it kind of rides that way for a while. So you're sort of leaned over, feel like you're going to capsize, but you just kind of keep driving along and you don't have a lot of control, and it's just uncomfortable and not super safe. So anytime you have falling seas, it's not fun. But anyway, for the check ride, I hooked up the tow for this boat offshore. I'd gone across the inlet, no big deal. It was probably breaking occasionally, kind of 6 to 8 feet, just kind of a mix of like steeper swells that aren't breaking like you'd see like a surfer riding. And then every once in a while, they'd actually white cap and slough over and expend the energy. And so I hooked up to the other 47 and started towing it back in. And as I got to the point on the inlet where it was steepening up to the point where it started to break, in hindsight, I didn't have enough speed. And so it allowed the other 47 in tow to get picked up really easily and set down the face of the wave behind it and essentially surfed for a second and then rolled over. It didn't go 360, but it did get a knockdown about 90 or 100 degrees in tow. So this is all happening behind me as I'm, you know, failing my check ride, basically.
Right, on your check ride, right, when you're already, like, pretty freaked out, probably. Like, those aren't exciting times. Those are, like, high stress levels.
And you got to go back and hang out with those guys afterwards.
Yeah, right.
The guys you just got.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, you go from being, again, like, being the unit focus where everyone's kind of under the impression that you're ready for this to coming back and being, you know, in no uncertain terms, like, a failure. But in the meantime, you still have this boat behind you that you just knocked down, and you're in the middle of the inlet that's breaking, and you have to handle that. So I was able to get the whole, you know, us and the tow turned around and headed back out to deeper water where it wasn't breaking, and we disconnected and made our way back across. And, you know, just pretty shocked and just surprised by the whole thing. And in hindsight, you know, it makes a lot more sense to me. It's kind of like if you try and merge onto the freeway at 15 miles an hour because you think, like, I'll be able to time it perfectly. It doesn't change the fact that the cars you're merging into are going 60.
Right.
You know, so at a certain point, you just have to get your speed up and just commit and figure that you'll find your spot when you get there. You know.
You know, so what's pretty telling, John, is that you guys drove, you unhooked the tow and then drove back across, right? So like they didn't even give you a second chance, man. So you scared somebody for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no, it's kind of, well, I mean, you know, when you do surf training, and if you have a knockdown or like, I mean, I've seen other units have this happen, pretty much that ends training for the day.
Right.
You know, the boat and the crew can be totally fine. It could be a really benign knockdown, but you sort of say like, we probably should just stop today.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, we've reached the level.
I think you just kind of used an oxymoron there, a benign knockdown. When the boat goes past 90, I think it stopped being benign at that point.
Well, I mean, I guess in relative speed, it's not like the boat went 360 and it tore the mast off, so.
Yeah, and I mean, but any number of things can, like, you know, lead to that, too. It's not like, a little bit of that's operator ability, a lot of that's just conditions on the ground, you know? I mean, you can do everything you can to prevent it, sometimes you just get caught off guard.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, it is a challenging environment, and there's no doubt about that. I mean, in that case, it was preventable, and there were and have been plenty of operators at Barnegat Light who towed across that inlet in just as terrible, you know, or challenging of conditions as I did. And, I think for me, again, it just highlighted, like, I needed some more experience in that domain. And so, you know, the next part of the story is later that year in the winter, then I went out again and had my second check ride, and same thing, went out, hooked up, started towing the boat back in. And this time, you know, and all the time since that I had practiced, I told myself, all right, remember, you know, get your speed up, get control of the boat. And when you're towing a boat in with waves off the stern like that, the way that you can keep them from surfing is by keeping the tow line taut. So you just imagine a string between, you know, the boat in front and the boat behind. If you keep that line taut, the one that's being towed can't really veer off to left or right much because the tow line, that string, is keeping it pulled straight. So even if it starts to get picked up and surfed by the wave, you've got control of it. And so by keeping your speed up, you kind of prevent what happened on my first check ride. So I'm approaching the inlet. Conditions are about the same. And keep telling myself, get the speed up, get the speed up. We get through the first kind of line of breaks, and things are good. And I don't know, 30, 45 seconds later, they start to get surfed by waves. So I do the right thing. I add power to keep that tow line taut and keep the bow straight. And things are looking good. They start to basically kind of rise up on the wave towards the top of it as the wave is essentially passing underneath them and keeping on advancing. Because waves actually travel pretty fast. They're going faster than we are. So the boat's getting picked up. And once it gets to the top of the wave, you should pull power back so that you don't pull it back over the top of the wave, because it's kind of like a teeter-totter at that point. Like, it's really precarious. If you give it a little bit too much power, then you can actually pull it back onto the face, and then it definitely is going to surf. And so that's exactly what happened. And I just didn't – I held power too long, and, you know, I have GoPro of this happening. You know, I look back, and you can just see the boat going over the top and then ending up on its side, just like the other one did. And so, saying, you know, it's like at this point, at least I had been here before where, you know, you have to respond to having a boat in tow that you knock down and you're still on the bar and all that. So same thing, I turned around, went out to sea and got us a deep water and stuff. And that was the end of that check ride. And because, you know, that was pretty much 5 or 6 months before I actually transferred, I kind of got put to the back of the line of the pecking order at the unit, which made perfect sense because, you know, they had 3 or 4 other break-ins that were going to be there for a while and could actually benefit the unit. So it's like, again, you had to fail, you had the learning gaps, you had to kind of deal with watching all your friends and stuff sort of surpass you in their qualifications. So it was just this whole experience for months, you know, just had this intensity to it that was challenging but was really, you know, good in the end. I think I learned a lot about wave dynamics and just the operations of the vessel, you know, and humility, I guess.
I would have liked to have been on that towed boat for that ride down the face of the wave. Man,
same guys on the boat the second time they were on it the first time? Because I would have liked to have heard the conversation afterwards.
I think the surfing was the same, and afterwards he said something, you know, he was kind of joking about it, but he's like, yeah, you know, as soon as we started going in and we went over the top of that one, he's like, oh, no, not again, but, you know, it actually was. And he filmed it, and the station put it up on their Facebook page.
Yeah, of course they did. Yeah, that's good.
Great way to be famous.
Well, you didn't pass the check ride. However, you did make us social media stars. I like it.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, so
that was my time in Barnegat. You know, I ended there with a lot of good experience and a lot of taste in my mouth of how to handle failure and how to, you know, learn from it and, you know, keep moving on.
And then for, you know, like I'm sure some of the listeners are probably young bosun mates, right, trying to enter the prospective surfman program. How did that translate when you got to Cape D? Because I know there's a difference between East and West Coast surf. How did it go? How did the qual process go there?
You know, I wouldn't say it was any smoother necessarily. I from day one, I wanted to be a surfman. I wanted to go to Cape D. You know, and I felt like every step of the way, the Coast Guard was just telling me no. And I took Barnegat because it was the only surf station open at the time, and it was awesome experience, but in terms of like a feeder for the prospective surfing program, you know, it's just difficult because the type of surf is different and the frequency of conditions there is just a lot less. So, I mean, in the 4 years I was there, you know, you'd have these storms come up. You might get 2 or 3 days of training and then it could be another month or two before you had conditions again to train in. So by the time you're going back out again, you're just knocking the rust off again. You're not really advancing your skills. And so it was hard for me to build a really solid heavy weather foundation. I'm also not necessarily the most intuitive hands-on person either, so I just need more time for those things. And so by the time I got to Cape D, I don't know that I had the foundation that a lot of people who grew up there as like BM3s did at the Cape. And so it took me about a little less than a year from the time I reported to Cape D to finish heavy weather and certify there. And at that point, I felt like I had really learned a lot of good stuff and demonstrated my proficiency and had a really challenging but like productive check ride. I definitely had to kind of like get up to speed with things at the Cape when I arrived.
You know what I'm curious of? What was your surfman check ride?
That is funny. I mean, I've seen it done a few different ways, a few different places. For me, it was kind of a culmination, and I think that's pretty typical where, you know, you get watched always, but you get watched really intently for a couple months or for a season, and then by the end, there's like a storm or a week or a day or whatever where you go out and you don't necessarily know it's your check ride, and you come back and surf and talk about it, and turns out it was your check ride. So that's pretty much what happened for me. It was in November of 2017, and so I had probably about 2 months of that surf season, because it usually starts in September, October, and picks up through the winter. So I had a couple months to kind of build on what I had built the prior spring and the prior winter. And it wasn't a particularly like crazy challenging day. I've definitely heard some stories of people who have insane check ride experiences. But it was just kind of after a couple days of doing different things, and we were able to get out and do surf drills in Classic Spit, which is kind of like a bar type surf zone, and also on Benson Beach, which is a beach type surf zone. They're pretty different. So we got to see kind of all sides of that, and that was my check ride.
Cool. Congratulations on passing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
without surfing a boat.
I think it's interesting, or it's maybe an important, you know, we always like to kind of figure out what kind of lessons are we taking from this. And it's for any of the younger people listening out there, any of those people coming up thinking about being a bosun mate or younger bosun mates, you know, coxswain's not a given. It's something that's got to be earned. And then that next higher level of coxswain, whether it's heavy weather or you're trying to be a surfman, or it's the pursuit or the tactics, whatever it is, they're not given. They are something that you have to earn. And, you know, kudos to you for not being discouraged, or at least not permanently discouraged. I'm sure it was discouraging when it happened, and keeping on with it, because it sounds like something that, you know, you're very proud of the fact that you were able to earn in the long run.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Very much so. And I think you said it really well. I do look back, and I'm glad I went through with it. And at the same time, I mean, if I had decided that was just too intense or too demanding or whatever, I mean, I wouldn't have been wrong for not doing it either. And I mean, if there's anybody who's listening who's in the position of, like, hopefully pursuing that, or even smack dab in the middle of that, like, I think both of those outcomes are totally acceptable, and there's worth to pursuing either path. You know, it's totally fine to just go do something different, whatever that looks like, and it's also fine to push yourself and stay in the one track, you know, and either way, it's going to bear a lot of fruit for you.
Right. There's a reason you don't see a whole lot of people walking around with that surfman pin on. There's certainly some real value there.
Yeah. And what's cool about the way things are going now, the National Motor Lifeboat School is doing a lot of things to revamp the prospective surfing program and make it into an actual program, which I don't really think it's ever been. I mean, as someone who was at one time for multiple years, basically a prospective surfman, I didn't feel like there was a program at all. And so they're making that path a lot smoother, a lot more thorough, and just a lot more realistic, so that I think people who are looking at it kind of know what they're getting into beforehand, and then they don't necessarily have to spend 6 years. I mean, if I look at the date that I got surfing versus the date that I was a coxswain, it's almost 6 years. And that's a long time. I mean, you can probably make an astronaut in the same amount of time.
So you're saying you're an astronaut.
Close enough. Close enough.
Yeah.
Well, John, let's talk about the memorial that you built, or the virtual memorial, we should say. Virtual memorial,
sure,
that you built. Because I know there's been a lot of discussion about this thing, and it's it was something that when I was at Golden Gate, we talked about all the time. And that was back in 2001, so it was pretty recent still, right? And then as, you know, as the years have passed, it still comes up. I've got the book on my shelf. But, you know, back in 1997 at Station Killiute, CG-44363 suffered a pretty tragic mishap. Could you just kind of lead us through? I know you did a lot of first-person kind of interviews to build this memorial out. And just describe it, man. Just talk about the process.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a process for me, too, just in my own development. And maybe I just start with sort of a disclaimer that, like, the incident itself happened in 1997. I was like 6 or 7 years old. So throughout all this, you know, I can't ever begin to speak really for those people or for those events in any way close to the way that they can. You know, the best that I can do is how I've sort of applied this to what I experienced in my career and just how I sort of see the domain today. But, you know, with that said, I mean, when I was a kid, pretty young, I learned about the Coast Guard and lifeboats and just started really diving into it. And so at some point in like middle school or high school, I probably read the same book you have on your shelf there and kind of learned about this for the first time. And pretty much from that point forward, every little step in the Coast Guard that I took, it had a way of sort of being relevant to me. You know, when you make coxswain or you make OD, there's a lot of things that as a fresh certified person, you can look at this mishap and make a point to just never repeat, you know, never have happened again, or never set yourself up to be in a similar situation. And so at every one of those points, you know, I was definitely keying off of what I had learned from it. And one of the big things that I learned a lot more from was I actually got access to the mishap report, which is public information. It's not classified or anything like that. When I was on the midget, I wrote to the historian's office because I knew that they had a file on this incident, and they sent me back a, you know, 80-page photocopied thing of the report. And so I would be on the cutter, like, reading through these firsthand accounts where they were being investigated and the timeline and all the findings and recommendations and stuff. And it just, it's always seemed so real to me, like, reading that stuff and envisioning it happening. And so flash forward to the past couple of years, you know, made Surfman, working kind of as the training petty officer for the unit and stuff, and starting to see some of the similarities in terms of just the challenges that we face every day. And that's pretty scary to realize. Like, we have all kinds of great gear. We have all kinds of great, you know, risk assessment tools and policies and stuff that's in place now. But a lot of those things still potentially are out there for us to trip up on. And so about 2 years ago, with the realness of that in mind, I kind of designed a first person group reading of the mishap. So I took a condensed version of the chain of events and sort of broke them off into like what happened to who, and made it into like a roundtable thing where we all read a script. So you might be a VM2 and I might be a fireman and somebody else might be the MK3. And so we each sort of have a part to read. And so there were about 15 parts, and we went around the room and read through the whole timeline of the events of that mishap. And then at the end, we were able to discuss it and kind of ground it in how it pertained to the unit. And it was pretty effective in terms of just kind of scaring the crew a little bit. And like, that sounds kind of dramatic, but I think that's actually what made it effective and useful, is just how it brought home, you know, what had happened.
Why don't you give us a summary, John, of what did happen, so that, you know, they can understand why it's scary, or listeners can understand why it would strike some fear into the hearts of many.
Yeah. So, you know, understanding that there's also things that happened months before and months after, but the actual case itself was, it started around midnight in February of 1997 on the 12th of February, and a sailboat that was offshore off the Washington coast, started to encounter some heavy weather. They called the Coast Guard to ask for conditions on the Cooley River bar with the intention of coming across. And pretty quickly thereafter, started talking with the station, and there was some time delay in terms of getting a position from them. Now we always make sure, like, the first thing we ask for is for a position. But a number of minutes went by without getting that information. And at the moment when they finally got asked for a position, just crazy how the timing happened, they got hit with a rogue wave and knocked down, and then their antenna damaged, so they weren't able to get their position to the Coast Guard. And so the OOD at the station, this is about 0020 in the morning, like really early, He basically hears that, you know, there's a boat that's been hit by a wave. They think they're taking on water. They had finally sort of conveyed that they were on or near the bar. So he launches in the 44-foot motor lifeboat with a crew of three others. And the OD at the time, the basic coxswain for that 44, was not a surfman. And, you know, it's nighttime. The conditions had deteriorated since he had seen the bar at last sight. So it's just a really, really crummy situation for him to be going out in. And the 44 was underway for about 15 minutes, if you look at the timeline of everything, when they, in a series of waves and stuff, were rolled over three times. They sort of struck a submerged object, encountered a wave, were rolled over, came back up, were disoriented, were hit by another wave, came back up. A short time later, were hit by a third wave, and eventually the boat ended up lodged in a cove on an island that was just offshore. And in the process, the coxswain, the engineer, and one of the crew members were all ejected from the boat and suffered significant head injuries and were killed and later recovered. And there was only one survivor who happened to be the most junior member of the unit. He had reported just a number of months before. And he basically floated with the remains of the 44 until it essentially washed itself up in the cove. And then he waited with it for, you know, 6 or 8 hours until there were four helicopters that were launched from Port Angeles and Astoria to the north and south. And before first light, one of them finally spotted him in the cove and then just kind of hung out there for moral support until they could get a high angle rescue team down in the morning to rescue him. And basically the whole thing wrapped up by about 10 or 11 the next morning. So just an insane case where an already small unit lost, you know, three of its members in one case. Destroyed a boat. The helicopter that was launched from Port Angeles, the first one, was able to rescue the two people off the sailboat when they finally figured out where the sailboat was at. And it just, it highlighted a lot of different problems, both in terms of what happened that night specifically, how units like stations and groups, or now sectors, work together and communicate together, how within a unit the officer of the day communicates with the senior duty officer who communicates with the officer in charge, and then bigger picture, how the Coast Guard assigns people to units, how they staff units, how they support units, how they have policies for using personal protective equipment, and you know, things like that, all kinds of bigger picture issues as well.
Right, and tragedy, you know, kind of prefaces a whole lot of change in the Coast Guard, and that was one of them that, that definitely prefaced a bunch of change in the Coast Guard. Who? Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, in terms of change, I mean, this was one of a couple pretty seminal events in the past 20 or so years that have directed things. Another one would be a couple years later in Station Niagara. Two people were killed, and that was a huge catalyst for changes in the rescue and survival program for the Coast Guard. And so together, these two things really put things in a new direction. And another area would have been with risk assessment and the Coast Guard's operational risk management initiative as well.
100%. All about, like, better protecting our crews and just making better decisions before and while you're out there, right?
Exactly.
Who did you talk to first person to kind of build out the content for your virtual memorial?
I talked to about, I don't know, between 8 and 10 people directly, and then a number of people just kind of on smaller details. But in terms of interviews and sitting down or talking to people on the phone, so I talked to people who came before who were at the unit before this happened, who were at the unit just after it happened. I talked to probably, I think, two people who were there, or maybe one person who was there when it happened. I talked to somebody who had been on the second boat that launched that night. I talked to a number of other either COs or officers in charge who at least were in the Coast Guard at the time or stationed nearby and have kind of had reflections of this throughout their whole career and sort of how this looks to them now. And I talked to a few people who were involved in the investigation process as well, because that was also really interesting to learn about. You know, you read the investigation and you hear how this is talked about today, and it's pretty much the synopsis that I provided. It's about the facts of what happened that night, and that's kind of it. But as you dive into the investigation further, you know, you realize that there were a lot of systemic issues that led up to this as well. And that's part of what kind of spurred me on to this virtual museum idea, was just realizing that there's got to be a way to convey the reality of what happened to people today that just goes beyond simply the timeline of it and puts into perspective for them, like, organizationally, the tough job that we all do. I mean, anyone who's at a station in the U.S. Coast Guard can pretty much relate to the fact that they're pretty short-staffed. It's difficult to handle turnover every year as it happens. And then it's kind of always been that way. And so 22 years ago, that was the case. And from the interviews that I conducted with people, that, you know, that's the case. And today, you know, I can speak from my personal experience, like, that's still the case. It's a challenge we still face.
100%. It's funny. I was talking to somebody the other day who, do you remember the Sea King?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Sea King, we all know the Sea King. Everyone in the Coast Guard knows the Sea King.
Your first place you sleep in boot camp, Sexton Hall.
Right. You know, somebody told me the other day, the Sea King was mentioned. It was brought up in conversation. The reply was, well, that happened so long ago. There's nothing else to learn from it. I disagree. You know, I think all of these, all these events shape the service to be what it is now. If nothing else, it explains why we do the things the way that we do them. Because a lot of things seem backwards sometimes. But in general, there is a legitimate reason written in blood that says, hey, we're wearing survival suits or we're wearing dry suits today because of XYZ, right? This happened. Someone lost their life because they didn't wear one. Exactly. I mean, same kind of thing. These things, even though it may have happened, a decade ago, still incredibly relevant, or 2 decades ago, still incredibly relevant to what we're doing now.
Yeah, and everybody I talked to, for the most part, had that exact same sentiment. You know, I was really concerned initially about being sensitive about this, because, you know, these aren't anonymous people that were just studying a case study. Like, these are three people who do exactly what we did, who have family and who have friends. You know, we need to be respectful about this. So everyone that I talked to, I wanted to make sure that I took that into account, and they all, you know, reiterated that this was important, that this was being discussed. Still today, it was important that it was being discussed in this way, and that a lot of these lessons have basically been forgotten, and that we're kind of in a position where we're kind of moving towards revisiting some of them or relearning them. And that to me is a really scary prospect, and just kind of solidifies why it's important that there's some way to facilitate more discussion about this, basically.
100%. So, you know, we're doing a podcast now, right? Because there's an impact to just talking to people, like actually hearing a voice and feeling the sentiment, you know, that comes through your inflection, your tone and everything that doesn't come through in a book. You getting to talk to some of the people that were involved, what was the most impactful conversation that you had? Did you take anything from those conversations that you didn't get from reading the mishap or from reading the report that wasn't just data, like something deeper?
You know, there's one, and it's maybe not as dramatic as I would have thought. A lot of the other ones, things like we've forgotten, or this mishap could happen again, or our training is focused on junior people because of turnover. Those things I kind of already had gleaned from what I had read or understood myself. But one of the ones that really surprised me was mentioned by somebody who had operated at Cooley River, and they said that if they were in the Coast Guard today doing training, they would want to make sure that people at their unit could operate in their area of responsibility without the tools that they often rely on. So, you know, we train on the boats regularly for GPS loss or loss of radar. But what if your aids to navigation get taken out, you know, or things like that? So at the time in Cooley River, they had stadium lights that shined on the immediate area around the bar so they could kind of see where they were in reference to the island and the channel that they were trying to go out through and everything. But they were actually inoperative at the time this case happened. And one of this person's sentiments was that they never trained for those lights to be out in heavy weather. And so the point was just, if you were at a station today, like, what are the things that you rely on, whether it's heavy weather or surf, you know, crossing the bar, operating, transiting inbound or outbound, what are the things you rely on that if they were taken away would completely, you know, put you out of your element? And how can you train today so that that might not put you out of your element as much as that ever happened? That was really, really interesting and something totally novel that I hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, very cool, John. I think that's a question everybody that's doing this mission right now should ask themselves, and then go out there and make it happen so you lose it and you train to do it without it. That's great.
Well said.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, hey, John, go ahead. Sorry.
Just basically, that's kind of how the Brewerton Museum kind of came out. You know, I had done the roundtable discussion with the people at my unit, and I knew I was getting out of the Coast Guard soon, and I thought of, like, how can I do this or present this practice up in a way that can benefit more people and be transferred easily, you know? And I started thinking about, what if I made, like, a map with, like, a Google map kind of showing what happened? And then, like, it just hit me. I need to make a virtual museum, and it'll be like a buffet where, like, you, like any museum, you can go and get whatever you want out of it, but it's going to kind of have everything on there. And that's basically when I started talking to those people.
Yeah, man. And you did a phenomenal job. I've spent quite a bit of time on that thing since you published it. I know a lot of others have too. So I 100% encourage anybody to go check it out. Could you give us the link?
Yeah. And thank you. It's uscg44363.wordpress.com.
Phenomenal job, dude, and one that I'm sure is going to carry forward and deliver some lessons to people that otherwise wouldn't have got them. So thank you for doing that from an entire community. I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely, John. Thanks for that. It's a really well done thing. It's anybody who hasn't seen it, go take a look. There's a lot to learn there.
Well, and like, you know, I just want to mirror that back at both of you as well. I don't know, you know, what exactly got you both into this, but I think it's super cool. It's something that, you know, I never thought somebody would make a podcast about first-person stories from the Coast Guard. And from within the Coast Guard, you know, it's going to be done right, and you guys are doing a great job with it and getting some not just cool stories, but cool perspectives and just honest accounts of careers in the Coast Guard that we can all relate to. So thank you both.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. And
thanks, John.
Stop building Bill's ego, please.
It's all Phil.
He's over there beaming.
I only have this job because I have a face for radio and podcasting.
That's good. Hey, John, again, man, we so much appreciate it. We wish you all the luck in your civilian transition. And something tells me that if you ever want to come back, the service will readily take you back with open arms.
Well, cool. Yeah, I look forward to whatever happens in the future. It's going to be good. So yeah. Thank you very much.
Good luck, brother. John. Thank you.
Thanks again.
All right. Take it easy.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org, that's CoastGuardFoundation.org, to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.